Omaha Public Radio, KIOS-FM, presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. Today's speakers will be Dr. Cheryl Pittner and Dr. David Krause. They will discuss the topic, stem cell research. Dr. Pittner is president of the Nebraska Coalition for Ethical Research, assistant professor in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Nebraska Medical Center, and assistant clinical professor at Creighton University. She is also on the Governor's Commission for the Protection of Children and Vice President of Nebraska Physicians for Life. Dr. Krause is a professor in the Department of Genetics, Cell Biology, and Anatomy at the University of Nebraska Medical Center, with courtesy appointments in radiology and radiation oncology. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, February 15, 2007, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Gary Willis.
I'm Gary Willis. I'm a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee. At least once a month, the Press Club sponsors a noontime forum at the club on issues we think is of interest to our members and the public at large. You do not have to be a member of the Press Club to attend these. We welcome the audience here at the Press Club today, and we also welcome our radio audience from KIOS. Stem cell research, it's an issue with religious and ethical implications. Celebrities have taken the issue to Congress advocating research. The government is deciding whether to allow federal funds to be used for scientific research. Today we have two experts to discuss this issue from two different perspectives. Dr. Cheryl Pittner is president of the Nebraska Coalition for Ethical Research. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Pediatrics at UNMC and assistant clinical professor at Creighton University. Dr. Pittner is on the Governor's Commission for the Protection of Children and is vice president of Nebraska Physicians for Life. Also, we have Dr. David Krause. He's an associate vice chancellor for academic affairs and professor of genetics, cell biology, and anatomy at UNMC. His research interests have been related to the redevelopment of immune and hematopoietic systems following bone marrow or blood stem cell transplantation. He has devoted his entire career to stem cell research. On the tables, we have pencil and paper, and at this, as time permits, please write down questions, and they will be picked up. Dr. Pittner, if you'd like to begin.
Good afternoon, and thank you all for being here. Just to start off, research in general is a very important topic, stem cell research being one of the topics that we have heard more about lately in the press. And the one thing about research is to know the goal of research. To take ideas, to bat around ideas, to get those research questions out, to not limit ourselves on what we can do, but look at that and say, okay, what can we do? What do we think we can do? Do that experimentation. Learn from the successes and the failures. Often in research, the successes actually come from the failures. You start down one line of thinking, and through the failures, you start seeing, well, this didn't work, but I noticed this over here, and you're down a whole different line of reasoning and a line of research. And so it's an ever-changing, ever-growing field. Stem cell research being one of the ones we hear about and also a very promising field. One of the things that's very difficult for a lot of people to understand who aren't in the midst of all of that is, what are stem cells? What is all of this about? What's going on? Not realizing that there's multiple sources of stem cells and they can do different things. Each have their own promise, their own advantage and disadvantages. And the one thing to remember, though, about stem cell research, though that is a very exciting and very promising field, and there's much to support with stem cell research, is that it's not the end-all and be-all of research. It's still just a small part of research. So we look at it in the picture of all of research. With stem cell research, there are different sources of different types of stem cells, from embryonic to fetal, amniotic fluid, umbilical cord blood, and adult stem cells that are taken from, it might actually be an infant or an adult body. Again, each of those have their own advantages and disadvantages. There have been the potential for each of these types of stem cells. Some of that has already been realized, and there's ongoing human clinical trials as with adult stem cells, others have that potential that has not been realized yet for human trials. And so if we look at each of those, the whole goal is research is to overcome those obstacles, those disadvantages, see what we can do with the advantages to produce cures or at least improvements in human conditions, diseases, disorders, or injuries. And so if you look at where we are, just real quick, with adult stem cells, there's over 1,100 clinical trials ongoing with adult stem cells. How many here know of anybody who's had a transplant with bone marrow transplant or peripheral stem cells or cord blood? I said, usually there's quite a few people because that research has been ongoing for decades. And the Med Center has been one of the internationally known for some of their bone marrow transplant. That's an adult stem cell transplant. Often it's not referred to as that because since it was one of the older and has been around for a while, it's before embryonic stem cells were discovered, and so it wasn't referred to as adult versus embryonic at the time. But now they're branching out. They used to think adult stem cells were not as flexible as embryonic, but they're learning every day that that isn't necessarily the case, and they're branching out. And some of those clinical trials are ongoing with work with heart attacks, diabetes, stroke, spinal cord injury, metabolic disorders, Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, and other disorders. There's several that are actually FDA approved already, mostly in bone marrow transplant and in work with anemias, but the research is ongoing to see if we can apply these to others to get the approval to use them in other conditions and disorders. The good thing about adult cells is that they come from you, and so your body doesn't reject them. There are disadvantages. Certain types of adult stem cells, certain sources in the body may be harder to find or harder to grow, but again, that's what they're doing the research for, is to overcome those obstacles. Amniotic fluid stem cells being one of the more recent discoveries, and often people refer them as embryonic-like because they are showing more flexibility and more promise. But again, we don't know yet what we can realize with that because they have recently been working with those. As with embryonic stem cells, they have not been doing research quite as long as with adult stem cells. Human embryonic stem cells were first discovered in 1998, but animal embryonic stem cells, where they do the initial research, have been around for around 20 years. There are yet no human clinical trials using adult stem cells. They have not developed the animal models enough to be successful to not have harmful side effects to proceed to human clinical trials. Again, some of the disadvantages of embryonic is potential for tumor formation, for rejection, since it's not the same as your body. But in theory, they think these cells are very flexible. They could become all the tissues of our body. So again, there's not as much realization of the theory behind embryonic as they've made progress with some of the adult stem cells. But again, what we have to focus on is that's the whole goal of research, is to say, what do we think the theoretical potential is? If you think about it with embryonic stem cell research, we all started as embryos. We all started at that one cell stage. The same DNA, the same 46 chromosomes in the cells in your body today were the same as that one-celled embryo, that zygote that was the beginning of your life. And so if you look at peer theory, it's a matter of getting those 46 chromosomes in an embryonic stem cell or an adult stem cell to do what you want them to do. It may take longer. It may take different roads to do that with each of the stem cell types. But again, that's the goal of research. And so what we have to look at is the goal of research, and what we do with research is we talked about that experimentation, that limitless part of what are the ideas, what can we do, we think we can do, and realizing I think everybody, researchers, lay people agree that research does not go on in a moral vacuum, that we have to take that limitlessness of what can we do, what do we think the potential is, and answer the question, should we do this, and is the process by which we're going to do this moral? And there are many Nuremberg Code, Declaration of Helsinki, that support ethical research, that put guidelines on research because of using human subjects and that protection of human life. And the first principle in all of those codes, and that has been defined, is do no harm. It is unethical to attempt research that will harm or destroy a human subject. So what the real core, the real basic, the real key of this whole issue in the debate with stem cell research, embryonic versus adult stem cell research, is human life and the moral status of human life. And that moral status during the continuum of human life from where we all first started at that one cell stage through our natural death, whether that's at 100 cell stage or 100 days, 100 months, or 100 years. Realizing that the difference is just the time to grow and mature. All the capabilities that we had were there at that one cell stage. And so what we have to look at is, again, limit. We should not limit the ideas in that think tank part of research, but then we have to funnel that into, is it ethical to then continue what we are proposing? One of the things that we have to look at in doing that is, it's interesting to me that when the subject comes up and the debate centers on the potential and wanting to move embryonic stem cell, which destroys embryos to obtain those stem cells, forward is that it's based on what is the promise of. So looking at common good, can we use these embryos and sacrifice these embryos for the common good? And it is a very good end that we want to cure diseases, help people who have had injuries or have certain disorders. But we have to look at common good. Who is that common good? What is human life? Where are we going to define that? And the discussion then sort of shifts. When we're talking about the potential, it's always the potential of life and what we're going to do and how we're going to help life. But then when we focus on, well, the key then is, are we protecting human life and doing the research? We sort of sometimes are shifted away from science and where it should be based. And then philosophy and religion is often brought in saying, well, there's different philosophies, there's different religious opinions, and since they can't come to a consensus, then we should just proceed. Since we can't define when human life begins or when we think that it's worth protecting, then the default should be, let's just go ahead. But if you go back to that basic principle of medical research, we do not harm human subjects. If we don't know, we should err on the side of protecting human subjects. That bringing in philosophy and religion kind of shifts things away from the argument. We have science on our side. We know when human life begins. Embryology, the science of embryology, tells us that. And in fact, over time, as technologies have developed, and as we know more and able to study more and see human life as it progresses from that one cell stage, that reinforces. Every embryology textbook tells us that zygote, that first cell, is the beginning of human life. When you began at that one cell stage, everything, all the capabilities, everything you possess today, how you look, what you were doing, was encoded. Remember, it's the same chromosome, so it's 46 in that first cell as the cells in your body today. And hopefully I still have potential that I'm still realizing throughout my life. It's just I'm a different stage of development than I was as an embryo. And so everything that you are today was encoded in that first cell. We know that first cell, genetically, it's human. And yes, it is alive, and it is an organism. It is self-directing, self-organizing. It doesn't matter whether it's in a petri dish with in vitro fertilization or in the fallopian tube where that fertilization happens in a woman's body. It's still the same. It's still a person growing, dividing, organizing in and of itself. And so we have to look at that this is human life. How are we going to protect that human life? One of the examples that people use to kind of get a picture of that too is when we start bringing in other characteristics and using philosophy and religion to define human life and protection of human life, then it becomes very arbitrary. It's someone's individual opinion. So we can't decide everybody has their own opinion. And so they use that as a default. They say, then let's just go ahead and proceed. But again, people use the example of a hunter. You know, they hear something rustling in a bush. They don't just turn and shoot, not knowing whether this is my partner who's out hunting with me, this is human life, or is this an animal. If you don't know, they don't shoot. In human research, if there is any doubt that this is human life, if there is no scientific proof that you can say, yes, this is not human life, then we need to err on the side of protecting life. And there are other ways that we can look at to avoid using. We've never said adult versus and embryonic are interchangeable or can do the same things. It really wouldn't matter if we didn't have an alternative to embryonic stem cell research. It's still taking that human life at an early stage of development and destroying it right now to get those stem cells to proceed. So if you look at common good, and as our country is founded on, all life is created equal. Now they're stepping in and saying, well, not really. Yes, it's human, it's alive, but it doesn't deserve the same moral status. We'll respect this embryo, we'll kill it, but we don't feel that it deserves the same protection. And they use arbitrary, very different criteria that can be ever-changing depending on who's presenting that criteria and what research that they want to do. To develop the argument around, we want to use these cells, so we'll define the argument based on why we think it's okay to do that. And so we don't have objective criteria. We're saying that one life, because it hasn't met a certain level of development, it hasn't met certain criteria, it doesn't look like I do right now, or it doesn't have the same thoughts, it can't be self-aware. Some people propose, Peter Singer is one, who his definition of moral status is you need to be self-aware, which doesn't happen until 6 months after birth or later. You also have to think, he says, yes, this is human life throughout. So you need to apply those criteria throughout. So you have to be willing to apply whatever criteria you use in an embryo to define their moral worth in every stage of life. And so there's this difficulty in saying, well, if we decide now based on this criteria, but then we decide later criteria change, well, why was it worth protecting now, or why wasn't it worth protecting? What is the scientific? Why are we taking the science out of this and saying we know this is human life? Why do we have to meet criteria, someone else's criteria, to protect ourselves? And that's one of the things we have to look at in each and every aspect of research, not just stem cell research. Looking at that too, embryonic stem cell research, when as a physician, I don't give meds. It's unethical to give meds to pregnant women, because of the embryo, because of that person developing inside of her. I can't give something that's going to alter and cause deformities in that child. It shouldn't be any different whether that child is inside or outside of the body. And so what we look at with embryonic stem cell research right now, you have to use in vitro fertilization embryos. There's no way that a woman knows that that embryo is formed and at the right stage to go in and take that embryo out of her body. And so what we look at is with in vitro fertilization embryos, they are human beings. We have put them in this position where there may not be a womb right now to implant them in, but that doesn't mean that it's right to take that life just because we've placed them in a position where they can't continue to grow and develop. It's another part of that, too, is just as the embryonic stem cell lines authorized for federal money by the Bush administration, a lot of claims this isn't enough, it's not going to supply the needs, why let us get started if we find successes and then have to stop? There is no restriction actually on embryonic stem cell research, it's just federal funding for that. Same thing with in vitro fertilization clinic, our embryos. If, let's say there are successes, they're likely quite a ways away, but undoubtedly, if we give enough money and time and research to this, there will be successes. So what do we do when we run out of in vitro fertilization clinics? Now we're saying, okay, we just got started. We need more. We need something that's going to match you or that matches you. There's not that diversity with in vitro fertilization clinic embryos. And so what we're doing is now saying, to a certain point, we now have to create those embryos, create this human life to then destroy them to get the stem cells. And the way to do that is using in vitro fertilization in a dish to create embryos solely for research and then kill them to get the stem cells, or use cloning. That way you've got a perfect match to your body. You've got match to your body. They can grow those embryos to the stage they need them, extract the stem cells. There's some research saying actually it's better to go even further, develop them to the fetal where those tissues are already being produced and then use those. So different positions in science, but all of it revolves around creating something specific to you to treat you if that's not already available. So then we move from taking a life that's already created, that was created for a different purpose, and saying, let's use that to creating life in and of itself to then destroy that to continue the research. So what we're looking at with the debate with embryonic and adult stem cell research is that we have to look at not what we can do with these cells. It's what should we be doing? Are we protecting human life? We know human life starts at the embryonic stage. Nothing, again, changes. Everything is encoded at that first cell that makes us who we are. In 20 years, when I'm in my 60s, I'm still going to be me. When I'm in my 80s, I may develop dementia, but I'm still me. I may have realized other capacities I do not have now. Just as in 20 years ago, there were things that I'm doing now that I wasn't doing then. I look different now than I did then. 20 years before that, when I was an infant, when you were an infant, you were the same as you are now. Your potential may not have been realized to the extent it is now. And keep going back. In utero, 7 months gestation, 5 weeks gestation, one day. You are you throughout the continuum of your life. And that's what we need to do in research, is to protect that. To uphold those principles that we have started, that our country is founded on. And we need to focus the debate on this issue. That's the key issue in whether this should proceed or not. But hopefully we'll hear that and engage in more conversation, not just what we can do for the common good at the sake of a human life. That human life is part of the common good. If we're sacrificing thousands or millions of embryos to treat others, we're not effectively doing what is for the common good. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, reminder, there is a pencil and paper on the table if you'd like to write down any questions you may have, and they will be presented after we're through. Dr. Kraus.
I'll add my thanks to Dr. Pitners for your attendance this afternoon. It is indeed a controversial topic, and I think that Dr. Pitner did a really nice job in overviewing parts of it, and in particular, just the basic ideas regarding science, how science works, that science involves asking questions and pursuing avenues that can address those questions and pursuing them through mechanisms that are accepted and ethical. And I don't want to just give up the ethical issue regarding embryonic stem cells to anybody, because I think that there are ethical bases by which you could justify that, and I'm going to come to that in just a minute. I think that Dr. Pitner did a really nice job of reviewing all of the stem cell science over quite a bit of time, and I'm just going to add a few things and kind of point out a few differences in terms of the way I see them. Indeed, stem cell research has been around a long time. My very first paper that I published as a scientist was in 1971. It was on stem cell science. It was way back then, before anybody really cared, before it was just those of us who were working at the laboratory bench, we call ourselves lab rats, sitting there doing our experiments and minding our own business, and nobody really bothered us, and it was quite good. This was all mouse work, although I eventually worked with human stem cell collaborators. I worked with the transplant team at the medical center and have a lot of good friends and colleagues that are involved in that process. And indeed, it has been a rapid growth area. Adult stem cell biology, though, gets a little bit messy when you start talking about applications of adult stem cells outside the realm of those that are related to the bone marrow, the blood, immunodeficiency diseases, certain metabolic diseases, and a handful of others. There's really remarkable progress and great things being done. I'm an adult stem cell biologist, basically. Great things being done with respect to cardiac disease, and I think that that's something that should be aggressively pursued. Some of the things that I like to point out to the public is that we really don't know whether the effects have anything to do with stem cells or not. Indeed, the effects that we're seeing potentially in cardiac work with cells that have stem cells present may not be related to stem cells. It may be related to altered metabolism and altered effects and healing that's stimulated in the heart that may actually regenerate stem cells that are present in the heart in very low numbers, and that may be the mechanism by which it occurs. Nonetheless, the biology behind it is fascinating, and those of us who watch this from the literature standpoint think that adult stem cells are still a very, very important tool that we need to invest as a country and as a scientific group a lot of effort into. I don't want to in any way downplay adult stem cells. And in the same way, I don't want to overplay embryonic stem cells. I will actually fault some of my own colleagues who make claims that embryonic stem cells are going to be the best thing since sliced bread with respect to clinical treatments. That's probably not true. They'll probably have limited uses just like adult stem cells do. We don't know what they are yet. They have not been applied in humans, as Dr. Pittner pointed out. It's a relatively new science with respect to human tissues, and it's been under a great cloud of controversy since they were first discovered in 98. It's been one controversy after another, and there are no clinical trials right now with embryonic stem cells. I think that there probably will be in the relatively near future, probably within the next 2 years. If not in this country, they'll be done elsewhere. There are many claims made for adult stem cells, though, that I want to make sure that people recognize are not very substantiated. In fact, they're not substantiated at all. If you go and look at some of the things that are claimed to have been treated successfully with adult stem cells, there's just no real good clinical evidence. They're anecdotal. They're single-issue, single-patient reports. They're not substantiated in the open literature. They're certainly not what we call evidence-based medicine. And indeed, none of those are FDA approved or anything like that. Not that you have to have FDA approval to do some of these things, but it certainly does substantiate the science behind them. So what we end up with is a series of diseases, among them Parkinson's, spinal cord injury, diabetes, a variety of others that simply really don't have a good solution yet. Not adult stem cells and not embryonic stem cells. So why the issue with embryonic stem cells? And the issue with it and the reason people are interested in embryonic stem cells are the successes that have been shown in animal models. The way research works, as Dr. Pittner pointed out, is that you ask the questions, you do the experiments to try and address the questions, and you collect the best data you can, and then you move on. Those start out sometimes in vitro, in other words, in a test tube. They then move into animal models. They move into more advanced and complex animal models. And ultimately, the hope is to bring them into the clinic and do phase 1, 2, 3, 4 clinical trials to find out whether or not, first of all, they're safe and then whether or not they're effective and how you can actually apply them. It's the way science works. Many of us hope, based on the animal experiments that already exist, in spite of some limitations of that, that the research can lead to clinical trials with embryonic stem cells. The one thing that Dr. Pittner did not get into that I want to make sure you understand is the source of embryonic stem cells that are currently used and that are being considered right now at the federal level in the House and the Senate. We expect the Senate to take it up soon. The rest of the Congress take it up soon. We expect that to be dealt with at the federal level soon. And you know already that our neighbors, Iowa, are dealing with a different piece of it related to cloning. Embryonic stem cells, as they are used today, come from excess materials from in vitro fertilization clinics. Many people object to the term excess materials from in vitro fertilization clinics. Let me explain what happens in the process of in vitro fertilization. Maybe you'll understand a little better. There are about 100,000 cycles of IVF done in the United States every year. That's 100,000 times that different women are treated and eggs are collected, fertilized, and then used for reproductive purposes. That generates a very large number of embryos. We don't even really know what the number is per year. The last actual count was done in 2003, and it was just under 400,000. Most of those embryos are reserved for reproductive purposes. The families that generate them want to use them to produce children. In spite of that, there are many that are left over. In that 2003 paper in Fertility and Sterility, there were about 11,000 that were specifically designated for research and left over and not to be used for reproductive purposes. If they are not used for research, they are destroyed as medical waste. They are incinerated. So the question becomes a little more difficult when you then balance the value, the beneficence that might come from this versus what bad thing might come from it. In the terms of the embryos that are going to be destroyed, there is no good coming from that destruction. Some people say we should not even destroy them, that they should be held forever. I can't argue that might be a possibility, but very expensive. So they are used for research. That's where the 72 cell lines that were approved by the Bush administration came from. That's where the about 22 that are actually available and about 7 or 8 that are used in the United States came from. So they came from leftover in vitro fertilization materials with appropriate consent, no monetary inducement, separation of the person who did the IVF from the science group, and so there's no real connection. That's where they come from. So the choice becomes destroy the embryos that are left over or use them for some good. And it becomes I'm the first to admit that that's a hard choice. That can be a very hard choice for people who see the early embryo as equivalent to a person. And that's kind of the next place I want to go. That is really the crux of the argument, is the status of the embryo. Those of us who believe that the embryo at that stage, and I do mean at that stage, that very early stage, might be more appropriate to use for research, do not see it as equal to a person. And I'll explain that in just a minute. Many countries who do use embryos in research and allow them suggest 14 days as a time. And that's when you begin to get trilaminar differentiation, you begin to get the primitive streak form. That's when the first beginnings of something that would involve structure really begins. Admittedly, the genome of the persons who produce the embryo are present in that embryo, but you are not a product just of your genome. I hope most of you realize that you're a product also of the implantation in your mother's womb at the time. There are what are called epigenetic effects, there are maternal effects, and there are environmental effects that occur after your birth. So many things produce you as a person, as an individual. Most of them begin, in actuality, beyond the genome, begin at the time of implantation, which is sometime between day 5 and 14. The other bright line that scientists believe might be an appropriate line to draw with respect to when does, and I'll use the term life begin, is then 14 days. A few other significant things happen prior to 14 days, or can happen prior to 14 days. Prior to 14 days is when twinning occurs, if you're talking about identical twins. Prior to 14 days is when triplets or quadruplets, or in the case of the Dionne kids, quintuplets, who are identical, can occur. So to say that a newly fertilized egg is a person is not necessarily true. It may be anywhere from 1 to 5 people. At least biologically, we know that that can happen. So the definition of person becomes a little bit more ambiguous when you accept the fact that we know that twinning occurs probably, or that multiples occur in that time between 1 and 14 days. The thing that a lot of people don't recognize is that it goes the other way. If you have two fraternal twins present in the uterus at the same time, and I do mean twins in terms of two embryos, in that pre-14-day period, they can also fuse. And these are called tetragametic chimeras. Those individuals grow up with a mixed complement of DNA in which some of the cells represent one of the fraternal twins and some of the cells represent a second fraternal twin. It could probably be more than two. It's not been reported in the literature. But at least reported and well reported in the literature are these tetragametic chimeras. Those individuals are actually two persons who are blended into one. If they're the same gender, we don't know that there's any adverse outcome whatsoever. If they're different genders, in other words, they're fraternal twins, they could be male and female, we do know that that is one of the situations where you get true hermaphrodites. And that's one of the biological situations that is simply just true. So there's something unique that can happen in that first 14 days that makes the definition of a person in that first 14 days a little bit more difficult to deal with. And that is why, in the absence of being in a womb, in being in a uterus, some people say that that's actually the critical step. The step at which we should watch carefully and regulate is when it is implanted. Once they're implanted, we should take very careful care to it. And you'll find that there are many people who consider themselves pro-life scientists and pro-life clinicians who still support embryonic stem cell research, but very much oppose abortion and any action that might interfere with the child after implantation or after normal fetal development begins, certainly fetal development. So that becomes a much more difficult issue. It's not quite so simple to simply say that these leftover in vitro fertilization products are just to be discarded and not otherwise used. The other thing is, if there's such great value placed on this early embryo, then maybe, and many of us believe, that the in vitro fertilization world should be better regulated. In some countries, they do not allow multiple embryos to be implanted. They restrict it to a single embryo so that there's no cause ever for embryo reduction. And that's true in a number of countries. There are some who argue that you should only fertilize one egg and implant it. You shouldn't collect the 15 or 20 that are collected and then many frozen, and that's why there are leftovers. That's another solution. But that's not the way it's working in this country right now. So for the foreseeable future, there will be a fairly large number of embryos generated and a fairly large number of embryos destroyed unless they might be used for research. Now, let me go briefly to the cloning, because I do want to address cloning. Cloning is really has become a hot button, and I know you all know that that is the current issue before our legislature in Lincoln, and I'm sure it'll be discussed in great detail there. I want to make it clear that nobody in their right mind, in my opinion, supports reproductive cloning, that is, implanting in the uterus any kind of cloned cells or system. That is simply... it's immoral, I think, in terms of you can cause great harm to the mother. We know that from the animal experiments, that that's a very dangerous process for the mother. We also know that it's very poorly successful, so that very, very few successes come out of it, and therefore the risk versus benefit in trying to do clone people is really, really not there. On the other hand, you're starting with an egg. There is no sperm. There is no fertilization. There's no conception. There's no pregnancy, there's no uterus, there's no fetus, there's no birth. All you're generating, for me, if it were my cells that were to be cloned in vitro, in the test tube, would be to produce for me, at my request, with an appropriate egg donor obtained by appropriate consent, cells that might provide therapy for me for a disease that could kill me. And that's what it boils down to. That's how simple it might be. Now, the first thing you need to understand is we aren't there yet with human cells. That has not been done. Somatic cell nuclear transfer has not, cloning, has not successfully been done for therapeutic or reproductive purposes for humans. It's been done in many, many other mammalian systems, but not in humans. It may never be done. But unless the research is at least allowed and at least not categorized as a Class 4 felony, when our neighboring state is probably going to pass it, and I can go home to Illinois and do it at Northwestern and be paid to do it, makes it hard for scientists in Nebraska to accept that this should be banned in Nebraska, made a criminal act in Nebraska, when virtually a handful of other states and places in the world have done that. And you're taking a big step as a state of Nebraska to impact science when you do that. It sends a message, even if we never do anything related to somatic cell nuclear transfer in Nebraska, it sends a message that we are not open to inquiry, free inquiry, in the realm of science that is accepted throughout most of the world and throughout most of the United States. So I want to kind of throw that out as a caution at the end. I also want to throw out one last thing, is I consider myself pro-life. I accept how difficult this argument is, and I'm never going to belittle somebody who says that, but I see it differently. I see the beginning of life at fertilization, and that two-cell being is a being. And I can't say you're wrong. I simply can't say you're wrong. I can disagree with what we do after that, but I can't say you're wrong, because that is a deeply held belief for many people, and I must respect that. So I simply... It is a very difficult issue for science. It is a very difficult issue for medicine. Scientists who believe this might be helpful don't walk into this trying to generate controversy. It's because they believe that there's something out there that might help people in a way that we probably can't do it otherwise. Nobody would willingly walk into this kind of a controversy if they didn't believe that there were some outcome that could be positive and that it is an ethically based choice in making that decision. So I'll be happy to entertain any the questions, and I'll leave it to you to moderate.
Okay. Let's see. The first question we have here. If you believe that using embryonic stem cells is unethical, what do you believe should be done with the leftover embryos? Dr. Pittner, if you'd like to address that.
Just as Dr. Krause pointed out, that all these issues are very difficult issues to deal with. The one thing to remember with in vitro fertilization clinic embryos. Again, it goes back to they are human life and need to be respected as every other human life is. With what to do with those embryos, that is a very difficult situation, and people have different answers to that. One Dr. Krause said, freeze them, keep them in frozen state, keep this human being in frozen state indefinitely. We don't know how long that may be, how long that they can actually survive frozen before they would potentially die in a frozen state. Another option is to, just as in any human life, allow them to live out their life in natural death. So thaw them and allow them to die and respect them and treat them as you would any other human being. A third option is there are organizations that will adopt out the embryos, that there are women who are, just as in surrogate parenthood, if a woman cannot carry her own embryo created through in vitro fertilization, they hire a surrogate mother. They can do that with these embryos that a woman and a man or a woman by herself is choosing not to implant and carry to term. The thing to remember about the in vitro fertilization, yes, I think we need to look at regulation. Should we be creating human beings at the embryonic stage, we're putting them in this position. We are not giving them a chance to live a full life, go through implantation. There's a researcher at Cornell University who is not involved in embryonic stem cell research or stem cell research. She's involved in infertility and has actually done research creating a really artificial woman, at least in mice and with tissue from the endometrium, can in a dish keep a mouse embryo implanted in that tissue in a dish and carry it to almost halfway through gestation and then implant it into the mouse abdominal cavity, never goes into the womb, and then deliver by a mouse C-section and have embryos that survive and that are still living, and mice that have grown and will survive and look identical to mice that are born through natural fertilization. There's that possibility there too. If we can create an artificial womb, what do we say then? If we can carry this outside the human body, implantation is just a change in environment. If we can create that environment somewhere else, or say we now can carry embryos outside the body to a 21-day stage or a 50-day stage, the heart's beating now, brain waves at 40 days. This is human life. It's just functioning at that level that it should. So we have to respect that life and not say, we put you in this position now. That gives us the right to take your life to use it for research.
Okay. Just add a small piece to that. And I think most people, with respect to humans anyway, would argue that that 14-day period in which, if you don't implant by then, in a uterus in a woman, then you don't have another option of trying to do this as some other sort of in vitro operation, and that that should be strictly controlled, just as if cloning of reproductive cloning of humans was actually very strictly controlled. So I don't think anyone favors doing that. I think the time and the issue we're talking about is that many embryos that are left, that are left over from research. We know that in that same RAND study that was published in 2003, that showed that there were 11,000 embryos left over and had been designated for research by the parents, there were 9,000 that had been designated for adoption or transfer. Some families simply do not want to do that. They simply do not want a genetically derived child of their own out there in the world that they're unaware of, and they refuse to donate them as embryos for adoption. I am in favor of embryos for adoption. If that can be done, and to a greater extent, I think that's a good thing. But even with that, there's a large number that are going to be destroyed, and there is no other end for them.
Okay. Next question. Some new parents have their baby's umbilical cord frozen to be available if needed in the future. Is this practical, and what would be gained by it? And also, I'd like to put another question in with it also is, are the stem cells from the umbilical cord, are they as good as other stem cells?
Umbilical cord blood, a little bit of background on that. how you get umbilical cord blood to extract the stem cells from is after baby's born, they clamp the cord, usually let dad cut it sometimes, hand the baby off, and then the placenta has to be delivered. So while they're waiting, they are able to insert a needle into the vein of the umbilical cord and draw off all the blood that's actually baby's blood on that side of the placenta. And there are millions of stem cells in there. The question about are they equivalent, I think both Dr. Krause and I have tried to explain that we don't know yet the complete capabilities of any of the stem cells. And there is a lot of potential for all of these. Some of the research already being done that they are probably a little more easy to work with than some of the embryonic stem cells for reasons of lack of tumor formation and things like that. But there's still properties they don't know. So we're not saying any of the stem cells are interchangeable. We don't know that yet. That's, again, the whole goal of research with any of the stem cell sources. Saving umbilical cord blood, is it feasible? Two options. You can save. If there is a very strong family history of a disorder that could be treated with umbilical cord blood stem cells, that may be an option for you. It does cost money. Usually the initial fee is around $1,200 to $1,500 for the initial storage, and then anywhere from $100 to $300, $400 a year. But maybe needing to save that throughout life, that child's life. But the greater use would be donating that umbilical cord blood to a bank, much like a blood bank. And that way it's available to the public to use for anybody who may need a treatment with umbilical cord blood. Just like bone marrow transplant, umbilical cord blood, it's newer. They have not discovered umbilical cord blood stem cells and working with them as long as adult and bone marrow transplants, but they're finding new and applying new uses. As we talked about the clinical trials, yes, some of them are just one case study or several case studies, but that's where things start. That's why. That's what leads to the other trials and the search for cures or improvements with the stem cells.
Can I add just a little bit? It makes me think of one other thing that's different about adult and embryonic stem cells that really is fairly important. Adult stem cells, which includes cord blood stem cells and amniotic, most of the others that people talk about, are not easy to maintain outside the body in vitro. So even though you can collect them from an individual and potentially do things with them, you really need to do it right away or freeze them down and do it fairly soon thereafter, because they don't, what we call propagate. They don't grow in vitro. They don't expand in vitro. There's some really recent papers that are showing that a new kind of adult stem cell called a MAPC, I won't go into what it means, but it's a special kind of adult stem cell that's derived from connective tissue, might have that capability. But there's only one paper right now really that shows that. So one of the advantages of embryonic stem cells is we've used the term lines and haven't explained it for you, so maybe I should explain what a cell line is. And that is when the cells are recovered from an embryo and grown in vitro, they're dispersed into a petri dish and grown up until they cover the bottom of that petri dish. And that's a plastic vessel outside in a tissue culture situation. They can then be subdivided and expanded in more dishes and subdivided again and expanded in more dishes. So you can get many, 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 many cells like the ones you originally had. And indeed, those cell lines, that's why 22 cell lines can be sent all over the world and people can use them and compare them from a laboratory like our investigators here in Nebraska might be using to a laboratory in California or New York or Illinois, and they can say they're talking about a given cell line with a given name. Those are cell lines. The advantage then is you can make many, many of those and you can do all kinds of things in comparative stuff. It's much harder to do that with adult stem cells. One of the limitations then with cord blood, for those of you who asked the question about cord blood banking, Cheryl already explained public versus private banks, the fact that you've got public banks in which the federal government now supports, where you dump the cells to this public bank, they get all carefully typed and made available to any situation in which they could be useful. They're like bone marrow banks in terms of being able to make them available. Private banks are the ones that Dr. Pittner mentioned with respect to paying your $1,200 a year, $1,500 a year. And if you put in Google cord blood and hit return, look on the right-hand side of the menu instead of down in the main thing, because what you're going to see is a whole bunch of ads for companies that now sell cord blood services. And I do mean sell. It's a very profitable business because it's gotten so much press. I'm a little the chances that a person would need cord blood for their own child, for their own situation, unless there's a really known and fairly well confirmed cause to keep them, I probably wouldn't recommend. I'd say go to the public bank. Maybe somebody else will need it and use it, and I think that's a very good thing. Cord blood is usually used for children. It's not, there's not enough cells there. Been a couple instances where people have been successfully transplanted as adults, but not very many. And so there's not very much use for adults, mostly for transplanting other children. And that's a definite need. I'm not putting it down at all. It's a very big need.
Just to tie into that, just to add too, though, but again, looking at relative time and things like that, there are some studies in with amniotic fluid stem cells that they do have the flexibility. They are easier to grow in culture than adult stem cells taken from our bodies. And so, again, with time, it's just an obstacle to overcome. So it doesn't mean they can't do it. It just means they're working on a process to work with them easier at this point in time.
Next question for Dr. Pittner. For the last 20 years, we have condoned the creation and certain destruction of human embryos to treat the non-life-threatening conditions of infertility. Are you seeking legislation to ban this practice?
I personally. and that's what we have to look at. And Dr. Krauss mentioned that, too, that we need to take a look at the industry of in vitro fertilization. Lots of issues there, lots of different layers on many different aspects. Again, a good means. But we have to look at there are countries who do limit not necessarily to one embryo. They may implant two or three, but that do not allow creation of excess human beings to put in frozen storage and are successful with in vitro fertilization. So it's one of those things that we don't have to create and destroy embryos to do in vitro fertilization, that it can happen without that. And we do, I think, need to look at how our country is using, creating, and then potentially abusing or killing embryos in the process and that whole thing. It's a whole nother realm. Again, just because I don't have the time to support every cause I feel passionate about does not mean that it's not a cause and an organization, that industry that needs to be looked at too.
Dr. Krauss, if human cloning for reproduction were safe for the mother and the cloned child, why should it be immoral to clone such a child? Should it be illegal? If illegal, who should be punished?
Good question. I think time will answer part of that. I personally don't believe that it should be done anyway. That's my personal belief. I think even if it were successful, I don't think it's necessarily a good idea. I don't think we're that desperate for new children. I don't think that that's a cause to initiate a pregnancy. There are lots of other situations. There are all those embryos that are frozen that could be used in that kind of a situation. But there aren't other solutions with respect to the generation of cells that might be used to cure me if I've got the defect that needs to be cured. And so I see it as really only one choice, is that if cloning is done, it is only done for the production of cells. It is not in any way intended to be done for the production of people. And I'll accept the fact that people argue, well, you've already produced the person. But again, I'll go back to my arguments regarding what happens in those first 14 days causes questions as to whether or not this is a person.
And just speaking of that, those first 14 days, and I alluded to it in my part of the presentation, is you have to look at a lot of the twinning, implantation, the different timelines, the different arguments for that happen at different timelines. They've kind of stretched some of those to 14 days. If you look at twinning, it's less than 0.5%, and the chance of fusion is even less than that. The most likely time for twinning is in the first divisions in the first few days after that human being is created. And so if you think about it, if there's a potential, you're actually taking two lives rather than one. But it still doesn't change the fact that that is a life. If another life starts, then you have two lives. And that decreases as time goes. At 14 days, when there's, they refer to primitive streak or something visible that we can see as far as organization, that's just some visible. It's not anything set in time, and that happens over a different period of time too. That primitive streak may not be till 15 or 17 days, and so you're looking at kind of something like quickening. They used to say, okay, it's not life before we knew about the science of embryology, and growth through ultrasound and other measures. You know, they didn't think life started until mom could feel that. It's not just because we can see that primitive streak or something there. That organization, that person is still there prior to that. And so some of those arguments you're looking at, they happen at different. Implantation usually is completed by 12 to 14 days, but starts at 5 to 7 days. But yet we're allowed to keep embryos beyond that when they could be implanted. So you have to look at all those issues together. Again, they're arbitrary things that they're assigning based on we need to keep them alive at least to that stage so we can harvest those cells. And again, with cloning, it is still a human person. Yes, it produces cells, a human being. It produces cells that you then destroy that being to get those cells. So it's not just creating that embryo through cloning and get cells. You have that human being to destroy to get the cells. One small thing to add is, again, it goes back to, again, we shouldn't always focus on can we do this research. Should we be doing this research? Do we really want to base our economic development, everything, on research that uses one human life to take another? So that is one of the pieces we have to look at when deciding what do we want to be known for. And just because someone else is doing it doesn't mean that we have to do it too. If, again, it's the limitless part of research is the ideas and the generation of ideas, then we have to translate that into should we be doing this or should we not. Just because someone else is doing it and can make money off of it doesn't mean that we need to do that too.
Okay, thank you. We have more questions, but due to time there, we're going to have to bring our program to an end. I'd like to thank Dr. Krause, Dr. Pittner for their presentation. We are adjourned at this point. Thank you.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. We've heard a discussion of the topic, stem cell research. The speakers were Drs. Cheryl Pittner and David Krause, both from the University of Nebraska Medical Center. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, February 15, 2007, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club holds these noontime educational forums each month. The next forum will be held on Thursday, March 15th at 12 noon. At that time, the guest speaker will be Omaha entrepreneur John Hoich. If you'd like to attend this or other future programs in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete noon forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.